days have become a touch longer on this side of the world here in London, another sign that spring has indeed arrived. But for many of us, it takes more than a few extra hours of sunshine to make running a palatable experience. Well, strap on your running shoes. We're talking to the editors of some of today's most beautiful fitness titles today on The Stack. Coming up on the program, it's our spring fitness special. We'll sprint through the pages of Meter magazine with its editor Andy Waterman, and we'll get all covered in mud as we take a run with Simon Freeman, editor of Like the Wind, plus a quick diversion to the shores of Japan as we add a touch of Tokyo to our fitness regime.
It would be great if by reading Shukyu, our audience became interested in the sport, but also football fans became interested in art, politics, or other topics that we cover.
Ready, set, go. It's all action on today's edition of The Stack, Monocle 24's dedicated print industry review and analysis show. Hello and welcome to The Stack with me, Tyler Brulé. Gazing outside the sunny windows of Midori House today, it's easy to see that spring is truly upon us. And while the storms earlier this week might have scared some of us indoors, it is that time of year where many of us start thinking about how to reignite that spark in our fitness regime. I'm joined today by two gentlemen who share some compelling answers to that question. Andy Waterman is the editor of Meter magazine, published by premium apparel brand Tracksmith, that sets out to take a long-form look at running culture. And Simon Freeman is the man behind Like the Wind magazine, an inspiring collection of personal anecdotes, beautiful illustrations, and stunning photography. Gentlemen, welcome to The Stack. Now, we've got two magazines here, as we were talking about in the intro, which are sort of largely in the same part of the world, at least in terms of the type of pursuit. Maybe if you could just set up for us, Simon, for people who have not seen your title, just tell us briefly, where do you fit into the newsstand? And I guess also rewinding a little bit, what was the gap that you saw in the market?
Okay, well, starting with that gap, the idea for the magazine came to my wife and I when we were running around the Mont Blanc for our honeymoon. And we were actually talking about some of the titles that we've got here on the table, cycling magazines primarily, that I was obsessively buying despite not being a cyclist. But I loved them for their editorial content and for the design. And we just wondered whether there would be an appetite for that sort of magazine in the UK, in running, sorry. So
just on that point, I mean, were you thinking UK or were you thinking internationally right away when you conceived the idea for the magazine?
No, we were definitely thinking internationally.
Right.
Because actually our idea was that we would be publishing something quite high value or high cost at least. So we thought that we're only going to be reaching a relatively small part of the running population.
Right.
So we would need to sort of distribute globally. So we came home and spent our dwindling savings printing the first issue of the magazine and kept our fingers crossed that people would want to buy it.
And how many issues in now?
We've just published number 8 and we're working on number 9 of a quarterly title. So,
and Andy, Meter magazine, of course, a title a little bit newer, out of the blocks.
Yeah.
I mean, format-wise, a few similarities. But again, I guess from your side, what was the realization in terms of scope in the marketplace?
So Meter magazine is published by Tracksmith, which is a premium athletic clothing manufacturer. And we're a running clothing company. And we were kind of looking at running as a sport and thinking it had just been grossly misrepresented by the brands who kind of look after it.
Mm-hmm.
The magazines were kind of all part of that, and really no one was representing our experience of running. I'm obviously from the UK, the company is from the US, based in Boston. We had a kind of a lot of shared experiences, which we just really, really felt that running deserved better. And there were so many stories out there that were going untold, and they just really deserved to be put out there in a beautiful format.
Just to both of you, do you think that on one side there's this incredible sort of sense of reportage and delivering sort of great stories, and it's very much a departure from anyone who's familiar with Runner's World, and so many of the other titles which of course are out there, which are very product focused and very much focused on diet, etc. I'm wondering if there's a middle ground though, because I feel that so much of the newsstand is about this sort of this great storytelling that everyone wants to do today. But at the same time, is there room for product and to do product well, you know, and over a series of pages at the same time, because there seems to be a bit of a gulf and divide, not just only running. I think even we look at a lot of cycling magazines, you know, I think, you know, as you were saying, Simon, there was that desire, there was that sort of, you know, looking at what happened at that part of the newsstand, which of course has now prompted things to happen in many other corners as well, whether it's tennis, you see all kinds of different magazines wanting to be in that territory. What your thoughts are?
Yeah, no, 100%. And actually, one of the things that we really would love to do is start working with brands in a really authentic way.
Mm.
I know we're going to get on to talking about magazines, but in the latest edition of Relais, there's a piece about a helmet manufacturer. And I kind of read it. I was really interested. I think the products are integral to the sport. I don't think they're in any way divorced. And Andy and I were talking about this earlier on, about the fact that these brands have huge history. I mean, very often they were facilitators of people doing great things. So I just think there's a bit of an education to be done with the brands that actually, if they're going to talk about what they're doing and their products, it needs to be in a way that is genuinely interesting rather than sort of a pure sales message.
Mm. I mean, Andy, you sit in a different, you know, I guess, in an interesting place, because obviously here's a magazine which is underwritten by a big brand, or not a big brand, but obviously a very boutique brand. So, of course, you have to play to that. So I'm wondering, is there a way of striking a balance, or has there been sort of an editorial decision, say, no, let's go and tell, you know, current issue, you know, whether it is a great piece about running in Japan, whether it's a profile of an individual, and let sort of, you know, product and everything else sort of really sit in the background.
Yeah, I think we're sharing more stories online now as well, and so we are actually doing some product focused pieces, but they tend to work better for us online. So we just published this morning a comment piece about choosing running shoes, and there's a lot of debate about running shoes. People love to argue about it. It's something that probably works better online than it does in the print magazine.
And why? Do you think because of just engagement, letting people have a go at each other? Or?
Yeah, because it will be shareable. It will be something that will start a conversation. The pieces in Meter are slower to read. They're something that you kind of sit back and you savour.
Mm.
And you don't necessarily get to the end and feel like, I need to share this. You've enjoyed it for what it is.
Mm.
I listened to a really good podcast yesterday, Ben Smith from BuzzFeed on the Longform podcast, and he was talking about exactly this and about the way online journalism can be shared.
We're going to go away for a very short break. You're listening to The Stack on a Saturday here on Monocle 24. We're talking about broadly the areas of fitness and, of course, covering a little bit of ground with Andy Waterman from Meter Magazine and Simon Freeman from Like the Wind Magazine. Short break. We're back after this.
Meet the Writers is the show in which we have a chance to get intimate with some exciting authors. Airing at 1500 every Saturday and available as a podcast thereafter, it's an in-depth discussion about the life and work of a different writer every week, with me, Georgina Godwin, on Monocle 24.
And you're back with The Stack here on Monocle 24 with a very special spring fitness edition. Now, Shukyu magazine is a Japanese football title that doesn't focus on the usual star players or analyze winning tactics. When co-founders Kohei Ito and Takashi Ogami launched Shukyu in May 2015, they featured a 92-year-old football journalist, a design proposal for Japan's new national stadium, and photographs of Japanese artist Masuno Hirayama. It was immediately clear that Ito and Ogami had no intention of catering to what we might call the typical football fan. Shukyu's name comes from an obsolete Japanese word for football, the Football Association's magazine that first appeared in 1931 and is thought to have been the first in Japan about the sport. In their magazine, Ito and Ogami explore the beautiful game's relationship to art, architecture, craftsmanship, and design. It's a publication by two football fans whose interests go beyond the goals, trades, and rankings. Ito, a web designer based in Berlin, and Ogami, an events planner in Tokyo, had never worked on the editorial side of a magazine before. They are now hoping to produce two issues a year with print runs of around 3,000 copies, and so far have found an audience in Japan, Germany, the UK, Hong Kong, and Taiwan. Our Asia editor, Kenji Hall, spoke to them in Tokyo.
In Japan, there's a perception that culture and sports don't mix. I was involved in both football and culture and thought that we could create something new if we brought a cultural perspective to football, which was one of the reasons for starting Shukyu magazine.
One of the things we thought about in starting up this magazine was that most sports magazines and newspapers are only for a limited audience. They're for people who once played the sport or fans who follow the sport. You might also see fashion magazines or culture magazines running an entire issue about football, which are fine for the readers of those magazines, but not for the fans of the sport. We wanted to find a way to connect those two audiences, people interested in arts and culture who don't follow football, and football fans who don't have much interest in art or culture. We thought that we could do this by drawing on the many years we've played football. If you look at the cover of Shukyu, it's different from a Japanese football magazine, which would have a big photo of footballer Shinji Kagawa on the cover. We use several small photos of all the topics we cover inside. One glance wouldn't tell you that it's a magazine about football, but it's the sort of magazine that football lovers and people with no interest in the sport could equally pick up and flip through. We thought a lot about that in coming up with the balance of photos on our cover. When we started putting this magazine together, we looked at magazines and books from around the world. There was photographer Hans Vandermeer's book, European Fields. Another was the Green Soccer Journal, which was started in London in 2010 and has since influenced many culture magazines. Another important one for us was The Soccer Tribe by Desmond Morris. Shukyu magazine is our own interpretation of what we liked about those publications. Most sports magazines target readers who are already familiar with the sport. Magazines like these tend to get highly specialized. We try to avoid doing that and target people who don't know much about football. We hope to broaden the appreciation of the sport. We like to take a step back and view soccer from a wider lens, like Desmond Morris did in his Soccer Tribe book.
In Japan, the reality is that football is popular when the national team is doing well and not so much when the team is struggling. So the sports following varies depending on results. If Shukyu magazine can show off a different way of enjoying the sport, we can broaden the fan base, so it's not limited to how well the national team is doing. Football is something that people are familiar with. Even if readers aren't so interested in the individual topics, viewed through the filter of football, they might. It would be great if by reading Shukyu, our audience became interested in the sport, but also football fans became interested in art, politics, or other topics that we cover.
Monocle's Asia editor Kenji Hall, speaking to the team at Shukyu magazine, and you're having a look at it there. Very nice issue. I like the composite cover. They haven't gone for a single image. You know, orange always, I think, does wonders whenever I look at our newsstand sales. A little bit of bright orange always helps. Just, you know, thoughts and feelings. I mean, I guess in my mind, for people who haven't seen it, it has, I think, many of the features of a lot of independent publishing. It's kind of in the world of A5 slightly. Of course, they've gone for good paper stock. My favorite story is just, I just love the piece on all of the injuries and people rolling around on the field, which I thought was quite brilliant.
Yeah, and there's mixed stock, there's inset stuff here, there's tons of illustration as well, which works nicely in a football magazine because it's just not something... Football's so heavily photographed, it's nice to see a different perspective on it.
Thoughts?
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree absolutely with what Andy said there, and I think that what's really nice is that they've clearly decided that whatever is the current vogue in football magazines, they're going to go in entirely the opposite direction. So it's very brave. Obviously, I don't know what the content says.
Right.
My Japanese is not up to scratch, but I think it's a really brave and interesting take on a subject that's well covered.
It's interesting. Maybe we should probably say just before we went on air, it was amazing that we don't really sort of vet what our guests bring in week to week. But we should probably start with the very large edition that both of you brought in. You've both got Victory magazine. So maybe I'll start with you, Simon. Tell us why did you decide to bring it in? And I guess first thoughts and impressions as well.
I've known Victory magazine for quite a few years, and actually I just think it's such a stunning size and format. It's just everything they do is able to look and feel totally different just simply because they publish a magazine that is such a crazy size. I love the fact that they cover so many different sports. You know, they're not focused like The Wind is purely about running.
Right.
They cover as many different sports, I think, as they can. And what they're able to do with photographs on such a large format magazine is just absolutely stunning visually. I love it. I think it's beautiful.
Yeah, it has this brilliant fencing cover, which is, and just the way they've got the light, I think, hitting, of course, the mask. So there's something arresting about that. And also how it just, it divides the front cover into the sort of this perfect hemisphere as well, which is fantastic. Andy, as well, I mean, you brought in same reasons. And I mean, you said you both, you're saying earlier that you sort of both agree about sort of the same values of the magazine. I imagine for a positive, I would think.
Yeah. I really see sport as a kind of Trojan horse that lets you get into people's minds and talk about other issues. And I think Victory is kind of one of those things where it does present sport in such a beautiful, well-considered light that it kind of goes beyond just being sport. It becomes art. It's culture as a whole.
Mm. Yeah. For those who are not familiar with the title, and it's just, it was interesting, Simon, when you talked about the format, we're in the territory of, you know, the original Interview magazine. It's bigger than, you know, let's say the vogue for a current title like or the revival of Holiday magazine. And, you know, in many ways, it sort of, you know, it does what it says on the label, very much also for the print industry as well. That this is, you know, aside from being a celebration of sport in all of its forms, this is purely a magazine front to back. I guess to both of you, do you feel it is a... Yeah. Is it a visual exercise, or is it also something that you do want to read?
It makes me want to read it because it is so beautiful.
Mm.
The previous issues I've read, and I've loved them cover to cover.
Right.
So I've got high expectations.
Editorially, it's really is fantastic. And I think that one of the things about the magazine, you know, when you immediately find a copy, the first thing you want to do is just indulge 10 minutes in just looking at these amazing photos, but the editorial content is really top class as well. It's really first class. The only thing is, it's not the easiest thing to actually handle. It's that big,
right?
You definitely can't get it in a briefcase or a reasonably sized bag. So it's almost like the most indulgent bit of publishing that I buy. You can't do anything other than sit in a cafe or on a sofa,
right?
Because it's that big. But
it is incredible when we look at sort of all of the, you know, the other titles around there. Like the Wind, when you thought about format as well, was that a real consideration in terms of usability in the beginning, that you thought, okay, someone is going to toss this in their tote because they're getting on a BA flight to Geneva, etc., so they're going to want to read it? Or did you just think, you know what, it was also economics as well, it was just the most efficient way of printing, especially as you said, you really had to reach deep into your pockets when you launched it as well?
Yeah, no, absolutely. We took the money that we'd been saving up and went to the printer and said, how many copies can we have? And they said, this number for the amount that you have.
Right.
So, but we also wanted something that was big enough to do justice to the photographs and the images and the illustrations that we hoped we would have in the magazine. So there was a bit of a balance there. We're not A4, we're off A4. And I used to work in the print industry briefly.
Right.
So I did know that A4 would be the most economical format, but we wanted something that felt slightly different, but not something that someone would sort of struggle to, as you say, put in a tote and take on a flight somewhere.
Right. Okay, we've sort of crossed the line with Victory. And what else? I see you've got the New Yorker there. You brought a sort of variety of things in. What do you want to talk about next?
I bought the New Yorker because I think some of the actual best sports writing happens outside of sports magazines. I mean, one of the best pieces I've read in the last probably 18 months was Ed Caesar on marathon running and the history of marathon running, which was a piece that ran in the New Yorker. And kind of sport as spectacle, running a full marathon in the Albert Hall on matting, you know, like, that kind of stuff is what really I find really entertaining.
Okay, I'm sort of looking over there. So, I mean, you've got Huck, you have Bolata, which you've got Roule. I mean, I don't know, should we maybe sort of move to talking about cycling? I mean, it is interesting, you know, as you were saying at the top, that's what was alluring to you at the outset, that you were looking at, you know, the world of getting into Lycra and pedaling on the winding road. Why do you think that sector, you know, somehow caught that particular moment? Because, you know, in some ways you could almost say that publishing almost sort of to define it and gave it some shape and structure in a media sort of popular culture sense.
Yeah, I wish I knew enough about that whole history of publishing in the cycling sector to sort of understand whether the magazines came first and created the spirit of the sport and the way that people respond to cycling, or whether it was the other way around, the magazines were a response to that. But it just seems to be that there's a large proportion of the cycling population who really care about the history and the spirit of cycling, which wasn't being catered to in running until Like the Wind and Meter came along. I think it probably existed. It just wasn't being catered to. What I love about these cycling magazines is they are talking about the personalities, the history, the you know, what went on in the sport and why people got involved in it. And that was what I was attracted to, even though I wasn't a cyclist.
And of what you brought in today, what stands out the most, would you say?
Well, I mean, I brought Relais because, you know, it was the magazine that we looked at as the one of the primary magazines. That and the Ride Journal were the two magazines that we really wanted to emulate. I actually picked up Velata on a trip to Barcelona. And what I love about it is it's not dramatically different, certainly in terms of format, content, etc. What I loved about it was the fact that it really represents this sort of multinational desire to talk about cycling. So, you know, the front cover is Bradley Wiggins in a Spanish magazine. So that was why I brought that one in, because I think it just shows that there's a sort of a universal spirit of cycling that translates into any language.
And if Simon does have the answer of the evolution of these titles, do you have any thesis on how it came about? I mean, you know, some could say it was the form of it. You know, some might even, you know, obviously we're talking about sort of Rafa as a brand at the top of the show. You know, was that part of also the definition that suddenly, you know, you had all of the technology that went with, you know, with bicycles, the boom, you know, both from an urban perspective, but then what happened on the country road. So the convergence is kind of fascinating.
I think you can actually track it back to about the year 2000, when the English translation of the book The Rider by Tim Krabbe came out. It's in English. He's a Dutch writer. He'd written this book about a bike race, and he was a chess grandmaster who'd become a bike racer in his mid-30s. And it's just such a fantastic evocation of competition, more than riding a bike, more than the countryside, but the competition of riding a bike in the countryside. It's just absolutely beautiful. And I don't think you would have any of the magazines that currently exist without that book. And probably you wouldn't even have Rafa, you know, like that was such an important translation, really.
Do you think that, mentioned Rafa, do you think that was a bit of a jolt of fuel, you know, perhaps for the market to then sort of give a degree of legitimacy for all of these other things to springboard off of it slightly?
Yeah, I'm convinced it was. And, you know, that was the time when Lance Armstrong, who we don't talk about anymore, was kind of in his pomp and really changing cycling into a sport that the people in the English-speaking world understood. And there was an appetite for it. And, you know, it was just the perfect storm of these different factors coming together.
You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. It is a Saturday, as it always is when we do this program. And of course, a focus today talking about fitness in a broader sense, springtime, everyone hopefully motivating themselves, at least on this side of the hemisphere as well. And my guest today, one from Meter Magazine, the other from Like the Wind. Simon, you've got a copy of Huck there. That title sort of pops up from time to time in studio. I haven't seen it here for a while. What caught your eye?
So the thing about Huck is, I mean, I love the design. I think they do a brilliant job on that. But actually, more so than that, I think it's because they campaign. They have a real point of view. And I would love to think that Like the Wind magazine could have a point of view rather than, and that I think is the antithesis of the sort of existing, the running magazines that existed before we launched. So I like the fact that they have an opinion and they definitely express that opinion in a very forceful way, despite the fact that it's supposed to be a skate magazine, punk culture magazine. So I sort of aspire for Like the Wind magazine to perhaps get some way towards that, actually have an opinion and say something, you know, really meaningful.
And what would that be, you know, within that context? Because obviously, if you think about running, you know, it plays to so many areas, whether it is urbanism and the built environment and how our cities functioned, and it cuts across to, of course, you know, diet and wellness and you know, probably so many intersections in between. But as you sort of, I don't want you to give away, or maybe you do want to give away your manifesto that people should sort of understand, but what do you want to work toward?
The message that I'd love to get across is very positive, and it's that running can really change people's lives for the better. So, you know, from a mental health point of view, physical health point of view, as you just alluded to, you know, how the built environment, how we use the built environment, I think all of those things, running has the ability to have a positive impact on them. So, you know, I don't want to become a tub-thumping, you know, title that sort of is desperate to just make a point for making a point's sake. But I think that there's something in running that inspires people. It's about inspiration. It's about kind of convincing people that they can just start somewhere and improve their lives as a result of just doing that very simple act of putting one foot in front of the other.
I mean, Andy, it's curious because that's one of the attractive things. You look at a brand like Tracksmith, that there is this sort of sense of, you know, don't give up, you know, you shouldn't have a day off. There's a lot of manifesto components to a brand when sometimes you think, actually, just lay off, you know, I just want to buy some clothes. And a lot of companies, you know, try to do that. But there is something, you know, aesthetically that Tracksmith is able to do. Then they wind a magazine into the mix as well. How much freedom do you have as an editor to also, you know, let's say, step outside what the brand is? You know, you talk about sort of the relationship that you might have with readers, et cetera, online to comment on things. But how much do you feel you also have to, even for purposes of legitimacy, you need to divert slightly?
You know, we actually have a lot of freedom. We talk a lot to athletes who are sponsored by other brands. Mm. We get to interview them. We really don't feel tied down to just covering ourselves, which I think is essential. I think the best magazines make you feel like you're part of a club, and our club is running. And that's really what we're trying to do, make everybody feel welcome.
And on that, you could say that, you know, many companies do that and are endeavouring to make that happen. The friction, though, between print and digital, do you have some pretty, I would say, sort of strict guidelines on your editorial floor as to what you're trying to push on screen every day, as to, you know, and also because you're not coming out weekly, you're not even coming out monthly. So also then figuring out, okay, what is that occasion then that has to be lived on the printed page?
Yeah, it really is the stories that kind of take a lot longer to produce and therefore probably take a lot longer to savor as well, once you're sitting down and reading them and really appreciating the stories that have gone into it. You know, when you're talking to an athlete who, in the next issue, we're talking to an athlete who was Bobby Gibb. She ran the Boston Marathon in 1966. She was the first woman to run the Boston Marathon. She ran it illegally, and she really helped change women's role in sport, you know. So there's something there that it doesn't do it justice to just read it as a 300-word feature online. It really needs to be sat down and savoured, I think.
Excellent. Gentlemen, we're going to have to leave it there. Andy Waterman of Meter Magazine and Simon Freeman of Lightwind. Very good to see both of you here. That brings us to the end of this edition of The Stack. But before we go today, and keeping in stride, we'd like to remind you that a rather large Monocle contingent will be in Milan for this year's Furniture Fair and will not only be delivering daily design coverage from the fair, but also hosting two early morning runs in association with Nike. If you'd like to tour the streets of Milan with us, and that's going to be on April 12th and also on the 14th, then please register with Kim Darragon at kd@monocle.com. My thanks to our producers today, Ben Rylan and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and of course, the very capable Claire Urban in the controller's chair. Next week, Tom Edwards is in this seat. I'll be joining him from Italy as I warm up the running route. Have a very good weekend. Goodbye.